Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's Monday, June 20th, 2022, live to be rebroadcast Wednesday, June 22nd, 2022 on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Manizza.
Yeah.
We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. If you're listening on Monday, June 20th, happy birthday to my awesome friend, mentor, and office manager, Amy. She is amazingly wise in so many ways. She always has my back and knows better than anyone what's best for our office. She is dedicated to whatever she does, including our office, naturopathic medicine, and organic farming. She has been working with one of the most wonderful earth-friendly farms out there, Tobacco Road in Lebanon, Connecticut, for many years. She's a kind, caring, forthright, principled member of our community. We are very blessed to have her in our lives. Enjoy your day, Aim. Yeah, and I'll bring you some pepperoni. Well, I gave you some pepperoni. Yeah, so our thing is at the end of the day, after the patients are gone, I still have work to do, and so does she. And so that time of day, you know, I haven't eaten in a while. I hadn't had lunch and probably didn't have, I had lunch and I haven't had a chance to have a snack. So we usually snack on stuff at that time of day. And one of the things I like to bring is uncured nitrate-free pepperoni. And okay. I've brought a couple of different brands and I keep it at the office. And I often will share it with Amy. Amy will sometimes get frustrated with me if I give her sweets because she loves her sweets and she will, you know, suck them down like there's no tomorrow. But when I bring her something savory, she's happier about that because it's a little bit healthier. So we like to share pepperoni. So here's pepperoni to you, Aim. And we'll share, may we share many more pepperonis in the years to come.
You're funny.
I love pepperoni. Really love it. I love it on pizza. I love it by itself. I love it on crackers. I love it with cheese. It's really good. And, you know, if you like to have pepperoni, you know, remember, fat is not the thing that raises your cholesterol. It's poor quality fat as well as sugar. And that's not going to be in pepperoni. And if you get pepperoni that has that doesn't have nitrates in it, it's going to be better for you. And I like it because it's a savory snack. It's a snack. It's ready to eat. And you can keep it in the fridge. Some pepperoni doesn't need to be kept in the fridge. And, you know, you can snack on it any time and it's protein and it's very satisfying and it might be a better choice than having a sweet treat at some times. And certainly at that time of day, later in the day, you know, we're the 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock hour, that's the kind of snack that I'm looking for. So it works very nicely. All right. So the other thing is today is a historic day because yesterday was the first federally mandated Juneteenth, June 19th, and today is the first federal holiday. It's a Monday holiday. They've made it a Monday holiday, and the banks are closed, and the post office is closed. So it's very exciting that they recognize this day, and it's a time where we can recognize the history of our fellow African Americans in this country, and you know, we can honor them and honor the fact that they were finally freed from slavery, and so we have this wonderful holiday to celebrate it. And there's been so many celebrations all weekend. So I just want a big shout out to my African-American family and friends. I do have African-American family. My brother-in-law is directly from Africa and my nephews are of African descent. So, and so I have a big, in-law family that is African. So, so beyond that, all of my African-American friends and loved ones, big shout out to you and blessings to you. So, all right. Last week we had a question from Carol, which I didn't manage to get to. She wanted to know what's going on if someone sleeps too much. For example, if someone sleeps 12 hours and then still feels tired a few hours after waking, what could be going on? Okay. So the answer to that is Oy vey. Yeah.
That's an interesting answer.
Yes. So I have people that come in and they have hypersomnia. Thank goodness they can sleep, but they sleep and then they wake up and they're still tired. So what could be going on there? A lot of things. So if this is consistently going on with you, it might be time to get a sleep study. So a sleep study is a polysomnogram, and it's where you go. Generally, to get a polysomnogram, you go to a pulmonologist. That's generally who does it. And the other thing is that various healthcare organizations, such as Hartford Healthcare and other health organizations, will have a sleep clinic. And they now have polysomnograms that there are machines you can take home and do the polysomnogram in your home. So if your symptoms aren't too extreme, you might be sent home with a polysomnogram. If they're concerned that you're really having trouble with breathing, then they're going to keep you overnight and you're going to have to sleep in the hospital and they're going to monitor you with a polysomnogram overnight. So what they're looking for in a polysomnogram is whether you are waking up with episodes of apnea or hypopnea, meaning that your breathing is stopping and your oxygen flow has gone down. They're looking for that. And they may also do a sleepy EEG. So that's an electroencephalogram. You're going to have electrodes attached to your head. And they're going to find out if you have anything going on electrically that is keeping you that's keeping you awake. So if you're sleeping 12 hours and then you're tired, you may not be aware of the fact that you're sleeping restlessly, that your breathing is stopping, and that you're having micro sleeps and you're waking up a lot. And you may not be aware of that. So you need to find that out. So that may be one track that you go on. That's one of the things that you think of. So the problem is sleep apnea is connected to cardiovascular disease, that people who wake up, they can get ischemic episodes and it can affect their cardiovascular system. So it's a really good idea to make sure that that isn't going on. It's not a good thing to have sleep apnea. And if you have sleep apnea, there are things that can be done to correct it. If you have sleep apnea, if you're overweight, if you lose weight, you might be able to sleep better because you'll stop breathing if your diaphragm is having trouble moving your organs down so that you can breathe better. And if you have a lot of mass on your abdomen, it makes it harder for the diaphragm to move, especially when your breathing slows down in the time of sleep. You're much more aware of what's going on when you're awake. So weight loss is one of the things that you do. The other thing to check is there are people with sleep apnea who are not overweight. I mean, I've had patients like that who are absolutely not overweight and are even athletes who have sleep apnea, and it could be for other reasons. There could be something neurological going on. There could be a breathing issue going on. The person could have asthma. The person could have allergies. There could be some inflammatory condition going on in the respiratory tract. So that has to be sorted out. So the problem with waking up, there's a number of problems with waking up. That sudden blockage of breathing can have deleterious effects on the cardiovascular system. You can have a heart attack from having sleep apnea. The other thing is if you're not having direct cardiovascular issues from having the sleep apnea, the problem with sleep apnea is generally what happens is you fall asleep, you gently drift off into dreamland. You get into your phase one sleep, and then you stop breathing and you wake up, and then you don't realize that that's happened. You go back to sleep, you go into dreamland, get into that phase one sleep and wake up. And so you never make it into stage two, three, and REM. That's so bad for you. Okay. So if you're only ever getting into stage one sleep, you're not going to ever be refreshed. You're not going to wake up refreshed, because you've heard me say before, stage one and stage two are basically preparation for stage three, your stage D sleep, your very deep sleep. And the deep sleep is nourishing to your whole body, to your whole physical body. And then your REM sleep is your brain detox. That's where your eyes move around rapidly and you detox whatever's going on in your brain, whatever you sort of synthesize memories, you synthesize thoughts that are going on. If you're processing something emotionally, that's the time that you do that. So, and as I told you before, you can dream in any stage of sleep, but your dreams in REM sleep tend to be the most vivid, and that's why you tend to remember them. And your REM phases get longer and longer as you approach the morning, and you're supposed to go through about 4 to 5 cycles of 1, 2, 3 REM throughout the night. And of course, if you have sleep apnea, you're waking up in your stage one sleep. You're never making it into 2, 3 in REM. So, and that's very bad for you. Like I said, it's very bad for your health, and you're going to wake up tired. So getting a sleep study might be in order if you are waking up, you know, sleeping 12 hours and waking up and you're still tired. So that's something to look into. Now, it could be none of those things. I mean, patient comes in and says, I'm tired, or I'm sleeping too much, or I'm sleeping not enough. There are so many things that could be going on. So hypersomnia that's not due to apnea, where the person is actually sleeping a lot, but they still feel tired, could be a lot of things. Could be an inflammatory condition. Which inflammatory condition? Any of them. So you could have an autoimmune condition. You could have Lyme disease. You could, of course, have long COVID. You could have any tick-borne illness. You could have a parasite. So you could have some kind of an infection, or you can have some kind of ongoing inflammatory condition, and that's what's making you sleep a lot. So those are things that need to be sorted out. And so the other thing is, of course, the patient comes in and they're sleeping a lot and they're also in pain, then I'm definitely going to be checking for autoimmune conditions. I'm going to check their anti-nuclear antibody. I'm going to check their rheumatoid factor and see if there's something going on there. So that's another thing. I might check their SED rate, which is the erythrocyte sedimentation rate. It's an old-timey way of checking just the level of general inflammation that's in your blood. They used to set up a pipette with blood in it, and they would check how fast blood would separate as to its various components. So when you set blood out just on a counter in a pipette, which is a long, skinny, calibrated tube, it will separate, and it will separate as to the red components, the red blood cells, and it will separate as to everything else, the water and all of the proteins and the immune globulins and the white blood cells. So the rate at which it separates, it's measured in milligrams per minute, and millimeters per minute. And the faster it separates, the more white stuff there is, the more inflammation there is. So it's a sort of quick and dirty way to check for general inflammation. It doesn't tell you what the inflammation is about. You can also check C-reactive protein, which is a protein that will rise if you have generalized inflammation. Again, doesn't tell you what the nature of the inflammation is. It's just a protein that rises when you have inflammation. There's general C-reactive protein, which tells you about general inflammation, and there's cardiac C-reactive protein, which is more specific to inflammation in the cardiovascular system. So that's something you're going to be checking for: generalized inflammation, inflammation for any reason, inflammation due to a microorganism. That's another thing you check. Of course, what else do you check? Nutritional components. You can have, you can be hypersomniac if you are iron deficient. So you want to check the person's iron. You want to check their ferritin, iron, and total iron binding capacity, and see if they're low in iron. And if you're low in iron, then you have to sort that out. Are they a vegetarian? Are they not consuming enough iron? So if you're iron deficient, you can be iron deficient because you're not eating enough iron. You can be iron deficient because you're not absorbing enough iron. And you can be iron deficient if you are losing iron. How are you going to lose iron? If you're bleeding. So then you ask the person if they're aware if they're bleeding. If it's a woman in her reproductive years, is she having heavy periods? If she's having very heavy periods, then she's likely to be iron deficient. And so then you can check for iron deficiency. And if you see it and then she says, yes, I have heavy periods, then you know she's iron deficient. You want to help her not to have such heavy periods, and you want to give her iron to take until she can get her iron stores back up. Why is she having heavy periods? Is it just a hormonal imbalance, or does she have endometriosis, adenomyosis, or does she have uterine fibroids? There's all these reasons why you could be bleeding from your uterus. If a woman is bleeding from her uterus and she's past her reproductive years, that's an emergency. That means not an immediate emergency, but it's an emergency that needs, the woman needs to go see the gynecologist, because then she needs an endometrial biopsy. You should not be bleeding out of your uterus postmenopausally. So that has to be sorted out. And so that's another one reason. If the person is not having heavy periods, or you have a woman come in and she's on chemical contraception and she's barely getting periods, or she's getting very light periods, then she's not iron deficient from the menses, unless she's just started taking them and she's has a deficit because she was bleeding heavily for months and months and months, and then finally got on her chemical contraception and that took care of it. And so you have to sort that out. The other thing you can find out if somebody's vegetarian or vegan and they're just not eating a lot of foods with iron in it. Now, if you're vegetarian or vegan, there are foods you can eat that have iron in them. You can be eating nuts and seeds. You can be eating leafy greens. There are things you can eat that have iron in them. And some people just absorb that iron better and some people don't. And so if they're vegetarian or vegan and they're not particularly bleeding heavily, or they're a guy, then you might still insist that they take some iron, an iron supplement, and they'll feel better and they'll have more energy and, you know, they'll make up for the fact that they're not getting it in their diet. The other thing to check out is if somebody's iron deficient, they could be low in hydrochloric acid. So somebody who's hypochlorhydric, you need hydrochloric acid in order to be able to absorb iron. And if you don't have enough hydrochloric acid, then you won't absorb your iron as well. And so you want to look for signs of that. What would be a sign of hypochlorhydria? They might have other digestive issues. Believe it or not, they might have heartburn. If you're hypochlorhydric, you can have heartburn from that because you actually have reflux. And the reason you have reflux is because you're not making enough hydrochloric acid. So your lower esophageal sphincter, the ring of muscle that closes off your esophagus at the bottom and doesn't let stuff come back up when you're digesting food, is sitting slightly open. And it's sitting slightly open because the pH in your stomach is too high. What's the pH? The pH is a term. It is a logarithmic term, which means it's orders of magnitude. That describes the concentration of hydrogen someplace. Okay, so pH, concentration of hydrogen. POH, concentration of hydroxyl ions. PK, concentration of potassium. That's all it means. It's a logarithmic, meaning it's just orders of magnitude concentration of a particular mineral. So specifically, pH has to do with the concentration of hydrogen ion someplace. So if you have a low pH in your stomach, that's a good thing. That, believe it or not, means you have a high concentration of hydrogen in your stomach. If you have a high pH, that means you have too much alkaline and not enough acid. And that's not a good situation because you need stomach acid to help you absorb iron, among other things. And you need stomach acid to disinfect your food and to initiate protein digestion. So if you're low in hydrochloric acid, not only might you not be absorbing iron, but you might not be, if you are not vegetarian, you might not be absorbing your animal protein as well. I think that I run hypochlorhydric because I don't do great with animal protein. I have to eat little bits at a time. The lower on the evolutionary scale, the better. And I do very well eating vegetarian food. So, if I eat a piece of fish, can't be a huge piece of fish. I eat kind of like Asian cuisine really works for me because lots of vegetables, bit of rice, little bits of chicken, that works for me. Big steak, not happening. Mammals, I haven't been into mammals at all this year, not because I'm against eating them for myself, but because my body is trying it. I'm trying not to aggravate it too much. And, usually we like to have hamburgers on very long bike ride days, and I've been insisting on taking turkey burgers rather than beef burgers. And I might change that, but I'm really enjoying, the thing is I do very well with turkey, so I'm going to continue doing that at least for a while. Ron gets beef for himself and he gets turkey for me, and everybody's happy. Anyway, some people run hypochlorhydric, and there's some relationship back in the when we would study Diadamo, and Diadamo would talk about the relationship between the blood types and what they tended to do well with. And I am a blood type A, and I classically present as a blood type A because I do very well with vegetarian food and not so well with a lot of animal protein. Not everybody fits that picture, but I happen to. So So that's something to look at. Do you digest protein well? Could you be hypochlorhydric? So if you are hypochlorhydric, what do you do about that? It's a couple things you could do. One of them is you could take hydrochloric acid. You can take betaine hydrochloride. And we try to you know, dial in a dose for you. You just get pills and they have hydrochloric acid in them and you take them and you see if you digest your food better. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to take digestive bitters. Bitter substances, bitter herbs tend to stimulate protein digestion. They tend to stimulate hydrochloric acid production in your stomach, and they also will stimulate bile flow through your biliary system, through your liver and your gallbladder and your pancreas. So if you take those, if you take bitters, you can eat bitter greens. You can simply eat bitter things in your food. You can eat, if you eat, you know, bitter, like arugula, any of the mustard family greens, they will help to stimulate your digestion. You can also take bitter tonics, and bitter tonics will have things in them like gentian. Gentian is one of the most bitter things you can take. Gentian and Sweet Annie or Artemisia. And I don't know why it's called Sweet Annie, because it is not sweet. Maybe I swear it's called Sweet Annie because some mom wanted her kid to take it and said, look, it's Sweet Annie. It's delicious. And it's not. It's very, very bitter. And yet it's an extremely helpful plant because it can help you to digest your food and it can kill your babesiosis and your other parasites for you. So good stuff. So it's going to have stuff like that in it. A bitter tonic will often have a bunch of things in it. It'll have gentian. It might have artemisia in it. Sweet Annie might have licorice, might have ginger. And the licorice and ginger aren't particularly bitter, but they are really good for digestion. Might have chamomile in it even, and chamomile is calming to the digestive system. I find those really helpful. So that's one of the things you want to do. You want to sort out somebody's hydrochloric acid status because there might be nutrients they are not absorbing because they have low hydrochloric acid. And so we talked about iron. So one more thing before I move on from iron is if you have somebody like a postmenopausal woman or a man and they're iron deficient and they are not particularly vegetarians, like they are eating red meat, they eat a good variety of food, they might have some digestive upset, but you can't really quite figure out if there's something else going on. You have to suspect bleeding elsewhere. And the next place you suspect bleeding is the digestive system. So you want to sort them out to see if they could have ulcers in their stomach or if they could have ulceration somewhere else in the digestive system. So especially if they're past 40, if they're 45 or later, you can do the very first very simple thing that you can do in the office. You can do a hemocult, which is you simply... doctor puts on a glove and takes a sample from the rectum and puts it on a little card that we have in the office. We have some developer and we see if there's blood there. If I'm concerned, I might do that. And I might also send the patient home with three of those cards and have them set up the cards with stool on three different days. I have them bring them back to the office and then I do the developing there and see if there's any occult blood there. You can also send them with a FIT test, which is fecal. It's just another fecal occult blood test, which they can put. It's very similar. They put stool on a card and they send it off to see if there's occult blood in it. And the other thing is they can do Cologuard. If you're suspecting bleeding, you probably don't want to do Cologuard because Cologuard is looking for DNA and you're really only supposed to do Cologuard if you have nothing going on. You don't have anal fissures. You don't have hemorrhoids. You don't have a lot of digestive upset. You haven't been diagnosed with something. That's when you do Cologuard. Otherwise, you have to think about having a sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy. If somebody's really iron deficient, I might send them to the gastroenterologist and let the gastroenterologist decide. I have had people go to the gastroenterologist and have them say, you know, I'm really not concerned about you having intestinal bleeding. And they have the consult and then they send them off and they just have them do their colonoscopy on schedule. And there are other times where the person, they will have a colonoscopy and they might find something. And so it's really important to find something if you have something going on in your colon, because if you have internal bleeding in your colon, you could, God forbid, have cancer. And the sooner you find that, the better it is to the better it is to treat. It's easier to treat. So this is from hypersomnia. Hypersomnia, we're relating it to iron deficiency and what you have to do about iron deficiency. Now, mind you, if you have hyperchlorhydria, you could be malabsorbing magnesium as well and calcium, two elements that if you're not absorbing them well, you won't sleep as well because you need calcium and magnesium to keep your nerves calm. And it's very common for people to be deficient in magnesium, not unusual at all, because in my practice, I see a lot of people who don't eat enough. They're just not eating well. They're not eating mindfully, and they're just eating on the go, and they're not getting a lot of greens. They're not like getting spinach from the local farmer's market and pureeing it into sag so that they're getting, you know, they're getting spinach that... you know, that's been pureed. So you're getting into all the nutrients that are inside those leaves. So so this is some of what we do. We get these wonderful greens from our farmer's market. This week we got arugula. I'm so excited. Arugula is my favorite. and so...
Spicy.
Yeah. By the way, I think I have something in my teeth. I'm going to move it.
Oh.
Yeah. There I did. Go. Yeah, I think I ate a berry this morning. And so, yeah. Okay. Anyway, I saw somebody advertising Better Health, and it was a very funny commercial. It was heart-wrenching, but it was also funny. It was a young woman who was talking as though she was in a therapy session, and she was talking about how her mind spins and all the cringy things she had ever done. And one of the examples was, what about that time I was in a job interview making a presentation and there was a piece of spinach in my teeth and nobody told me? And this is what she was spinning by. I felt bad for her because, boy, she's really anxious. I mean, to me, if I'm in a meeting or on Radio Naturopath or, you know, in an interview and somebody says, you know, you have spinach in your teeth, that's an opportunity for comedy. That's how I see it. You know, it's like, oh, geez, well, you caught me. I got spinach in the teeth. Thanks for telling me. You know, that's an opportunity for comedy, for connection, and it's a very human moment. People get stuck in their teeth. It's a thing that happens. And if you get kale stuck in your teeth, you should be proud of that because you ate kale. You know, and I just need to point out, there's really nothing to be embarrassed about getting stuff stuck in your teeth. Somebody might tell you and you're like, oh, thanks. You're done. Okay. Nothing to worry about. I felt bad. But this one was an example of somebody who was very, very anxious. And it was an ad for one of those online counseling services. And when they panned out, she was talking as though she was in a therapy session. She was sitting on the toilet in a public bathroom. That's where she went. She was just speaking. And it was an ad for, you know, you don't have to be sitting in the public bathroom. You could get an online counselor and they could help you and they could actually talk to you and help you. So anyway, that was interesting. All right. So what else? Hypersomnia. Other things that can make you sleep too much is if your thyroid is not working properly. So, you know, you come in and you're hypersomniac. I'm gonna assess you for all of these things: iron deficiency, calcium deficiency, magnesium deficiency, potassium deficiency. Are you eating your vegetables? Are you anxious? Are you hypothyroid? If you don't know if you're hypothyroid, if you are, you already know you're hypothyroid. I'm gonna assess: are you taking enough medicine? And if you don't have a current thyroid test, I'm gonna offer you one. If your insurance doesn't cover me ordering it, I'm gonna send you to wherever you need to go to get your thyroid checked. So if you're hypothyroid, that can mess up your sleep. It can make you very tired and it can make your sleep less effective and you're going to wake up and you're not going to feel tired. We talked about infections. Around here, there's going to be a high suspicion of tick-borne illness. Lyme disease and any of the tick-borne illnesses can make you very tired. So can COVID, so can long COVID. So these are all things that you want to check on. So let me see. Have I thought of everything that can make you hypersomniac? Well, The other thing is one of the ways you can be inflamed is if you're not eating properly, if you're eating food intolerances. So if you're eating too much sugar, or if you're eating something that causes inflammation in your body, if you're eating gluten, if you're eating dairy, that could be a problem. You know, I'm going to do a general blood workup on you. And I didn't mention vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 is something that can energize you. And if you don't have enough, you can also be tired because it's something that tends to run your nerves. Any of your B vitamins, if you're deficient in B vitamins, you can have less energy because B vitamins run your nervous system. They are cofactors for metabolism in for your neurotransmitters, and they help your nerves to run more efficiently. And they help you with sugar metabolism as well, so sugar and starch carbohydrate metabolism. So if you're not metabolizing your carbohydrates well, you're not gonna feel good, and you're gonna be tired. So these are all things we're going to sort out. Some of them we might test, and some of them we might just, you know, say, here, try this B complex, because, you know, it's not harmful to try a B complex, and, you know, we see how you do with it. So that's another thing. So like I said, there's so many things that could be going on when somebody comes in, number one, and says, I'm tired. Number two says, I'm sleeping too much. I have a patient who has hypersomnia who is gluten intolerant. And when they eat gluten, they sleep more. So a food intolerance can definitely make you sleep more. You're going to have less energy, because why would it do that? Because it's creating inflammation. When you are chronically inflamed, your body is going to compensate by making you sleep more so it can repair itself. And it's in this constant state of repair because you are inflamed. So eating a food intolerance isn't just about upsetting your digestive system. It could upset any part of you. So please be aware of that. And it could be any food intolerance, not just gluten, not just dairy. And then sugar can be an intolerance, but it can also be that when you eat too much starch and sugar, you deplete yourself of things like magnesium and B vitamins, because the sugar that you're eating doesn't have magnesium and B vitamins that you need to, doesn't have the magnesium and B vitamins that you need to metabolize the sugar. So that's a situation where we might give you a B complex, and we might suggest that maybe you don't eat so much sweet, you know, eat less sweet stuff, eat more fruits and vegetables. You're going to be more replete with good nutrients, vitamins and minerals that you might need. Okay. So that was a great question, you know, because hypersomnia, issues with sleep and issues with just fatigue, so multivariate. There's so many things that could be going on. So it's a really good question. So thanks to Carol for asking that. All right. So this week, we wanted to talk about the difference between arthritis and bursitis and how to help with mostly bursitis. So the American College of Rheumatology defines bursitis as the degeneration or breakdown of the soft tissue around the muscles and bones. And this is similar to what occurs with arthritis, although they happen for different reasons. Bursitis and similar conditions like tendonitis are usually the result of minor injuries or repetitive overuse, whereas arthritis is a degenerative joint disease that's sometimes caused by an autoimmune disorder. But you can get arthritis from overuse as well. You can manage the pain from both conditions similarly, since movement usually makes symptoms worse at first. Long-term, you can manage both conditions and prevent them by staying active and exercising regularly, eating a healthy diet, taking natural anti-inflammatory supplements, stretching, and controlling stress. You can develop bursitis because of sports or work-related injuries and trauma, being in an accident like a car accident or falling that impacts a susceptible area of the body. When you're healing from surgery, if you move suddenly and pull or strain muscles, overtraining can cause bursitis if you're over-exercising. Also, if you're exercising with improper form, you can get bursitis. If you have bad posture, also if you're sitting for long periods of time, which a lot of people do at work, they're on their computers. Other inflammatory conditions that affect your joints, like arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, gout, if you have scoliosis, where you have a curvature of the spine, if you have infections, thyroid disorders, psoriasis, and psoriasis would be if your psoriasis is affecting your joints. Also, if you have an autoimmune disorder, another autoimmune disorder besides psoriasis. If you have bone spurs or calcium deposits, they can irritate the bursa around your joints. If you have a leg length discrepancy where one leg is significantly shorter than the other, and leg length discrepancy can be anatomical and it can be functional. Anatomical means that one of your bones is literally shorter than when it grew, when you developed, one of your bones didn't grow as much as the other one on one side versus the other. That's an anatomical difference. It can be functional. Functional means that there's nothing wrong with the length of your bones, but you have tightness. You have tendonitis, or you have tight hips, or anywhere along the way. Usually it's tight hips that will give you a leg-length discrepancy. And we learned about this when we were studying naturopathic manipulation, which is similar to chiropractic manipulation. When we were studying that, we would look at people, and most people had some degree of leg-length discrepancy. And that's not because their bones are different lengths. It's because they have tight hips. And one hip is tighter than the other. And I know for me, you know, when I'm doing my hip-releasing exercises, I know that one hip tends to be tighter than the other. And it can be different on different days, but I'm pretty sure it's usually my right hip is tighter than my left. And it's hard to tell because an exercise might be harder on one side and easier on the other. And it may be different depending on how that, whichever hip that's tight, plays in. So that you can get leg length discrepancy. And then if you go to the chiropractor or body worker, massage therapist, craniosacral therapist, or whatever, you know, natural, whatever body worker that you're using, they can check your leg length and they can do their manipulation on you. And then you might find that your leg length has evened out. And I've experienced that both personally and when working on people. If you participate in high-risk activities that commonly trigger bursitis, that can be yard work like raking or gardening or carrying wood, carpentry, shoveling, painting, scrubbing, various sports like tennis and golf. Tennis and golf, you can totally get bursitis because that's going to be an overuse thing both in the elbow and in the shoulder. Skiing, throwing and pitching, you know, if you play baseball or any sport where you're doing some throwing, what can you do about it? In terms of conventional medicine, you might be using NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Over-the-counter NSAIDs would be like ibuprofen, like Motrin or Advil, and naproxen, like Aleve. Prescription NSAIDs might be diclofenac, which is very commonly used, and diclofenac is being used more commonly topically now. Ketoprofen, also known as Arutis, and naproxen, which is the same as Aleve. Using NSAIDs over a long period of time can increase the risk of stomach bleeding and heart attacks. So you have to be careful overusing those things. And so because bursitis is inflammatory, you would use an anti-inflammatory to treat it. Remember, if you use acetaminophen, commonly known as Tylenol, acetaminophen is not an anti-inflammatory. It is an analgesic. It calms pain. It does not reduce inflammation. So even though you might feel better, it's not going to reduce the inflammation that you have going on. You might be given a shot of corticosteroids. If they inject a corticosteroid into the bursa, it can reduce inflammation. Corticosteroids can be used for long-lasting inflammation. And there are definitely risks associated with corticosteroids. You can't get them very often and you can't get too many of them. Why? Because corticosteroids are an analog of cortisol, the hormone that comes from your adrenal glands. And cortisol's job is to run around your body finding things to break down so you can get more sugar into your blood. It turns whatever it finds into sugar, puts it into your blood so you have energy to run away from the bear or to do whatever it is that you're doing. But you use enough cortisol or corticosteroids, high cortisol suppresses inflammation, which is why they put it into joints, why it's injected that way, and why you're also given a course of prednisone for whole body inflammation. And you take enough corticosteroid and it will suppress your inflammation. So it's not advised. If you can find any other way to take care of it, it's really better. And, you know, I try to keep people away from corticosteroids because I have tricky knees. I don't have bursitis in my knees as far as I know. I have been diagnosed with joint degeneration in the knees, but my knees generally don't hurt. And I do a lot of exercises to strengthen and stretch them. And I primarily ride a bike. I don't primarily run, so I'm not getting a lot of impact on the knees. And, you know, I'm countering it with a lot of stretching and strengthening. So my knees generally don't hurt. They're doing better than they have in a long time. When I do get into a situation where I'm riding my bike a lot and I need to calm my knees down, I'll back off on how much riding I'm doing. I'll make sure I get more, I'll get acupuncture, I'll get more chiropractic, and I'll use KT tape, a wonderful tape that I put on my knees. All right. So how do you help your bursitis if you want to try not to do it with pharmaceuticals? You can eat whole grains, fruits and vegetables, fatty fish to help to reduce the inflammation. You want to try to stay away from processed foods and sugar and foods that are high in sugar and poor quality fats, because they will increase your inflammation. Poor quality fat will insert itself into your cell membranes and you'll have poor quality cells that you're with your body taking up those fats. Supplements. So there are supplements that can be helpful. You have to be careful when you take supplements. Supplements are not always the main thing, but they can be useful. And you want to make sure that they're not going to interfere with your medication. You can talk to your friendly local naturopathic physician about whether they're going to interfere with your medication. You want to make sure that anything that you take works well with anything else that you're taking. So glucosamine sulfate. So glucosamine is a substance that's found in cartilage. It covers the ends of bones in your joints. Some evidence suggests it can help the pain of osteoarthritis, and it may also reduce inflammation in bursitis. It does increase the risk of bleeding. So if you're taking blood thinning medications like aspirin, clopidogrel, or warfarin, you actually need to avoid glucosamine. So if you have an increased risk of bleeding because you're already taking a blood thinner, you shouldn't take glucosamine. It can increase your cholesterol levels too. So you want to use caution if you have a history of asthma or diabetes. So you have to be careful with glucosamine. Having said that, I have a lot of patients who take glucosamine if they don't have those bleeding risks, and they do very well with it. And because it can increase, it tends to increase the rebuilding of cartilage in your joints. And if you have more cushioning and more cartilage, that's going to help reduce the inflammation in the bursa. Omega-3 fatty acids, they are wonderful. So they are also anti-inflammatory, and they're anti-inflammatory in that they're not blocking inflammatory situations. They're increasing your own natural anti-inflammatory compounds in your body in the PGE1 and PGE3 series. And the other thing that they do is they help you to rebuild your cells, because omega-3 fatty acids are part of all of the cell membranes in your body. So you can rebuild healthy cells in your bursa and your joints. You're going to have more cushioning, and you're going to have healthier cells, and you're going to have reduced symptoms. Again, omega-3 fatty acids are great for thinning your blood, so you have to be careful if you're taking aspirin, clopidogrel, or warfarin. But you can take them. There's a level at which you can take them. Whereas if you're taking glucosamine, you may not want to take glucosamine if you're on blood thinners. Whereas omega-3 fatty acids, you have to eat them. You need them in your diet anyway. There's a level at which you can take them, and it's okay. Then vitamin C with bioflavonoids. They're great for connective tissue. Has wonderful anti-inflammatory compounds. You need vitamin C to strengthen your adrenals. If you have good quality cortisol in your body, you're not going to have as much inflammation, because it's going to manage your immune system well. And vitamin C is very much a part of your connective tissue, such as your cartilage. You have to be careful again with vitamin C around other. It can be a problem for blood thinning medication, so you have to be careful with that. Again, you probably don't have to not take them at all, but it's something you have to look into. Then there's bromelain. And bromelain is pineapple enzyme. It's a wonderful anti-inflammatory. And the way that it works is because it's proteolytic. It breaks down proteins. And the inflammatory compounds in your body are, in fact, proteins. So it helps to break down those proteins in your body. Also great for thinning the blood. So you have to be careful with if you're taking blood thinners. And also if you have any, if you have peptic ulcers, if you actually have ulceration in your stomach, you don't want to take bromelain. Not everybody can take it. I can't take it. It gives me an upset stomach. Sometimes it will just give you an upset stomach. But if you can take it, it can be wonderful. It does so many great things. It's antimicrobial. It breaks, it stops inflammation. It can help with pain. And it also, it's antimicrobial on its own to the point where you might not want to take it if you're taking an antibiotic because it has a synergistic effect. You can combine turmeric with bromelain and they can work well together. But again, they're great blood thinners, so be careful if you're taking blood thinners. So then there's Boswellia. Boswellia is, that's a lovely herb. It's frankincense, and it's also wonderful anti-inflammatory. And I have a hard time with Boswellia because it bothers my stomach too. But if it doesn't bother yours, it is a great anti-inflammatory. And Boswellia, there are a lot of the people who are in the essential oil community, they use topical Boswellia, frankincense, for inflammation on various places in their bodies. And Boswellia is often combined with turmeric, and perhaps rosemary is a great anti-inflammatory, so it can be very helpful. And then turmeric itself, combined with bromelain. Turmeric has components in it called curcumins, and the curcumins and curcuminoids, and that those compounds are lovely anti-inflammatory things. It can thin your blood, so you have to be careful if you're taking blood thinners, but can be a wonderful anti-inflammatory. It can knock back autoimmune conditions. It can knock back inflammation. It's really quite an incredible herb. And turmeric, if you're going to take it and you want it to get into your body, you want it to decrease your bursitis, then you need to get turmeric that has been enhanced so it can be absorbed, because it's poorly absorbed, which is great if you're trying to reduce inflammation in your digestive system. But if you want it to get to your joints, then you need it either to be attached to phosphatidylcholine, which is something that your cell membranes are going to take up because that's a component of your cell membranes. So you want it to be, it's going to be either liposomal or it'll say phytosome. That's one way you could take it. And you can also take it if it's water dispersed and it's going to get in very nicely that way. Turmeric also is highly enhanced by combining it with bioperine, which is black pepper extract. Black pepper extract increases turmeric absorption by orders of magnitude. So that can be very helpful too. Again, if you want the turmeric to get in and just fix your digestive system, you can get an inexpensive turmeric that's not well absorbed because you want it to go through your whole digestive system. But if you want it to get your joints, it's better if it has bioperine with it, if it's phytosome or liposomal, or if it is water dispersed. Then there's white willow, Salix. So willow has salicylates in it, so it acts similarly to aspirin. You can drink it as tea, and you can drink a lot of it, but again, don't take it if you're already taking NSAIDs, because you only take this if you're not taking any NSAIDs at all, because you're taking salicylates when you take it. That's how it works. So it's directly anti-inflammatory that way. The nice thing about white willow is if you're getting digestive upset by taking your NSAIDs, white willow has bitters in it to protect your digestive system. And you can use it with turmeric as well. Then there's homeopathy. Homeopathy, there's not a lot of studies that have examined the effectiveness of specific homeopathic remedies. There are people who use homeopathy to help help with bursitis. So when you're using homeopathy, you want to use it based on the indications of that homeopathic remedy. You can use arnica topically, and you can take it internally. You want to use arnica if you have a sensation of bruising. It can either actually be bruised or it can just feel like it's bruised. If you don't quite have that situation going on, the arnica might not work. It doesn't hurt to try it. You can put the gel on or the salve, and you can take it internally and see if that works. Rutagraviolans, I really like. Rutagraviolans is not so much about that sensation of bruising. You can just have a sore joint. You can have sore ligaments. Rutagraviolans is great if you keep spraining things. You have bursitis in your knee and your knee's unstable. So if you have any issues with the ligaments themselves, rutagraviolans is a great one. And I like rutagraviolans both as a homeopathic remedy and also present in salves to stabilize joints. So I have a muscle and tendon salve that I've had my local herbalist make up, and it contains rutagraviolins in it to help stabilize the joints. There's comfrey in it. Comfrey is not just for healing bones. It's also for healing ligaments. So it's got comfrey, it's got rutagraviolins, and it's got solidago, which is goldenrod. And goldenrod is a wonderful anti-inflammatory, and it's a wonderful anti-inflammatory for joints. So I have that in the salve as well. Bellus perennis is daisy, English daisy, which is also great for, it's so sweet. It's such a sweet flower, and it feels bad for you, so it wants to help heal you. And, you know, you can put Bellus perennis happens to be for really bad wounds. Like, there, dear, let me help you. So it's similar to arnica. You'll often use Bellus perennis if arnica hasn't worked. And then Rustox. So Rustox is homeopathic poison ivy. And no, you're not going to get poison ivy from taking Rustox. Although, if you have, if you take Rustox and you don't need it, you could get a rash from it. It doesn't usually happen, but it also won't work. But Rustox Echodendron you would use for an injury when the injury is better heat. So, and that's common for osteoarthritis. It could be possible for bursitis as well. If so, you have a sore joint and you want heat on that joint, and the joint feels better when you start moving it. But if you move it excessively, it's too much. Rustox Echodendron could be what you need. So Rustox, I give Rustox when whatever it is better with heat, whether it's a poison ivy rash or a rash of any kind or a joint. If it's better with heat, then Rustox might be helpful. And, you know, you can get compounds that have a bunch of these things in it, and you're going to hope that one of the homeopathics is going to help with it. I love acupuncture. Acupuncture is wonderful. Acupuncture helps to, it's not just for pain only. It's for bringing your whole body into balance. You're basically, you have meridians, channels of energy that are associated with all of the organ systems in your body. And the energy can get to a point where it doesn't flow as well along those energy lines. So you can put needles in, you can put pressure, you can, there's different things that you can do, needles or pressure, or you can even do Qigong, and that will help to sort out the energy flowing properly along those meridian lines. And once you get them in the right place, you might have less inflammation and pain. So chiropractic obviously can be helpful. Studies vary, as to whether chiropractic is helpful, but people go to chiropractors all the time, and I know for myself, chiropractic is extremely helpful. So chiropractic hasn't been studied specifically with bursitis, but it certainly helps with all kinds of pain. And the chiropractors report there's increased range of motion in use, in the use of chiropractic. Chiropractors do spine and joint manipulation, and they might use other treatments to treat bursitis. They might use cold therapy. They might use ultrasound therapy. Remember that chiropractic, like acupuncture, is a whole body treatment. It's not just about adjusting your spine. It's not just about taking away pain. I was explaining to my friend, I had this autonomic nervous system issue, and I'm going to the chiropractor to help me with it. And my friend didn't understand why going to a chiropractor would help my dysautonomia. And I said, well, because he's doing a lot of different things. He's adjusting my whole body and it's bringing my whole body into balance. It's not just about making sure my spine is aligned and that I'm not in pain. It's about holistically affecting your whole body. And the fact that when your spine is in alignment, all of the nerves that run to your organs are going to run in a more efficient manner, and they're going to be more helpful to you. And so getting your spine into alignment does help you for whole body balance. But Dr. Suez also does interesting things with me, like he does cold laser, and we talk about supplementation, and he does some energy therapy. So depending on the chiropractor, chiropractors can do lots of different things. They can be really, really helpful for you. Movement therapy. If you exercise your joints, or exercise the muscles and tendons around the joints, helps to reduce pressure on them. If you do gentle yoga, if you do gentle stretching, if you do yin yoga or restorative yoga, if you do Pilates or Tai Chi or Qigong, and you do gentle movements, gently moving the joints and doing range of motion exercises with the joints that are inflamed. It can help to flush out and move inflammation around those joints. Getting massage can be helpful. You don't do massage if your bursitis is caused by an infection because it can spread the infection. But if we're clear that it's not caused by an infection, that's because of chronic irritation or an injury or something, then you can use massage around the areas. Myofascial release therapy can be particularly helpful because you're moving the fascia and you're going to help to increase the circulation to get rid of the discomfort. All right, so let me see if there's anything else I want to tell you about bursitis today. There's a lot of different remedies. Some people use honey and apple cider vinegar. Some people, you can use ginger poultices. You grate ginger and you put it directly on the joint. You can use alfalfa, take it internally. You can use castor oil packs right on the inflamed joint where you would put flannel and castor oil in it, warm it up a little bit and put it on the joint. Sesame or olive oil also you can use instead of castor oil. Lavender oil in the bathtub can be helpful, or lavender in a carrier oil can be helpful. You can do a potato poultice. Potatoes make a great poultice. You can grate a fresh potato, put it in a paper towel, and put it on your joint. You can do sandalwood paste. You can get the... you can grate sandalwood, you can get the herb and grate it in water and you apply it over the joints, which can calm pain. You can do cayenne pepper and apple cider vinegar. So the apple cider vinegar will transmit the cayenne pepper to the joint, and cayenne pepper releases capsaicin in it, releases substance P, so that can help with the pain. Vitamin E oil can be helpful as well. It's going to be antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. Then there's emu oil, and emu oil is high in omega-3 fatty acids, just like fish is, and people who are allergic to fish can often use emu oil, and that can be used topically as well. We use it for skin irritations and inflammations. We use it for eczema and psoriasis. It can also be used for bursitis. Ice or alternating hot and cold can be helpful, and of course, stretching and yoga. So there you go. So we talked about hypersomnia today, and we talked about bursitis. So we had some great information for you today. Everything you ever wanted to know about bursitis, which is a really good thing because a lot of people have it, and everything you wanted to know about sleeping too much. So I'm going to go. Next week, I'm going to be coming to you either on Saturday or Sunday because I'll be working on Monday because I'm going away next week to the Cape later in the week. So I'll be here myself on Saturday or Sunday. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk about health and natural, it's a talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores, and WHUS.org.